You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
Good evening. I'm Aryeh Nair. I'm President Emeritus of the Open Society Foundations. And it's a great pleasure for me to introduce Rosa Brooks this evening. Rosa is a professor of law and associate dean at Georgetown University Law School. She is also a fellow of New America and a columnist for foreign policy. Her career includes service with both the State Department and the Defense Department. She was in the State Department Human Rights Office during the Clinton administration, and she served in the Obama administration in the Department of Defense. As counselor to the Undersecretary of Defense, and after a period, she directed a rule of law and humanitarian policy office within the Department of Defense, which in effect was a human rights office in the Department of Defense. Rosa also has a long connection to the Open Society Foundations. About 20 years ago, Gara LaMarche, who just walked in, engaged Rosa as a consultant to help establish the early United States programs of the Open Society Foundations. That was about 20 years ago. And then about a dozen years ago, Rosa served for a period as special counsel in the office of the president of the Open Society Institute at the time that that I was the president of the Open Society Institute. And her connection to the Open Society Foundations also includes service today as a member of the board of the U.S. programs of the Open Society Foundations. She has written an important book. Rosa has what I think of as an effervescent writing style, which makes it a pleasure to read, even when she is dealing with the gravest issues. And so it's not only a book that is worth reading, but it is a book that is enjoyable to read. If you haven't obtained a copy, there are copies for sale outside, and I think Rosa can probably be inveigled into to signing books if you purchase a copy this evening. So, Rosa, why don't you say something about the book, and then we'll open it up for questions and discussion.
Thank you, Aryeh. I will go up here. Aryeh, thank you. Thank you so much for that kind introduction. And it, for me, it is fantastic to be here at the Open Society Foundation, because what Aryeh did not say is that this book would not even exist had it not been for the Open Society Foundation and for Aryeh. When more than 10 years ago, 12 years ago, Aryeh asked me if I would be willing to write a short think piece. He wanted to put together, this was a couple years after the 9/11 attacks. This was before stories like the Abu Ghraib torture scandal had broken. And he asked me, he wanted to put together a group of people to talk off the record about the question of whether international humanitarian law was adequate for the challenges posed by non-state terrorism. And he said, would you be willing to write a think piece just arguing no, and I'm going to get somebody else to write a piece arguing yes, and I think that will help create an interesting discussion if we have, you know, two pieces that frame the issues in very different ways. And he even offered me a little bit of money, and I thought, great, I'm broke. I was a broke young law professor, junior faculty member, and I was very happy to accept that. And so I wrote a short paper, which led to a very lively internal discussion, which made me start thinking about these issues and turned into a law review article, which I guarantee absolutely no one is going to ever read, which eventually led me to try to write this book in the hope that somebody other than my student research assistant would read it. So if it hadn't been for that, the book would not have been written. And the year I spent here as REA's special counsel, which was a fancy way I was saying of saying that I was a fellow, sort of hanging around doing my own work and putting together some colloquia on civil-military relations and other issues, the book never would have been written. So REA, thank you so much for all of the work that you have done over the years, but also for playing such an important role in enabling me to write this book. It was not completely a foregone conclusion that I would end up working at the Pentagon. Some of my earliest memories are sitting on a picnic blanket at Central Park celebrating the end of the Vietnam War. I don't remember much about it except that someone gave me one of those little lollipops with crossed sticks, which I found extremely exotic, and this event has lived in my memory ever since. My parents were very active in the anti-war movement. I certainly did not grow up thinking I'm going to go work at the Pentagon. I ended up marrying an Army officer. My mother took a while to adjust to that, although she eventually said, I guess it's good to have an armed wing of the family. My father is sitting here now, and he's making faces. I always also try to bring my family with me to these events. In case the audience isn't big enough, it's good to have your family fill it out. I'll tell another story about my mother, actually. When I was at the Pentagon, I'd been working there for maybe 6 months or so, and I asked my mother if she wanted to come and have lunch with me at the Pentagon, and she sort of gave me a suspicious look, and you know, she had last present at that building trying to levitate it, and she said, okay. So my mother comes to lunch at the Pentagon. She comes through the visitor entrance. Arye, in fact, once had this experience. Arye also came to visit the Pentagon with me at one point. But she comes through the visitor's entrance. She gets through the multiple layers of security. We're walking through the corridors, and we're walking past the food court, and we're walking past the florist shop, and we're walking past the candy shop, and we're walking past the CVS and the souvenir store and the running shoe store. And suddenly she stops still. And I stop. I look at her, and you know, what's wrong? And she says, you're telling me that the heart of American military power is a shopping mall? Yes, as a matter of fact, yes. She wasn't far wrong. You know, the Pentagon is the world's largest office building. It has 17.5 miles of corridors. It has more office space than the Empire State Building. It's just sort of short and squat rather than tall. There are 23,000 people who work in it, and over the years, the Pentagon itself has sprouted dozens of shops and restaurants to cater to the 23,000 military and civilian employees who work there. And over time, the U.S. military itself has come to offer a similar kind of one-stop shopping experience to the nation's top policymakers. So it's slightly surreal today. At the Pentagon, you can buy a pair of new running shoes, or you can order up a Marine Expeditionary Unit to patrol in the Philippines. You can buy some Tylenol at CVS if you have a headache, or you can order a team of Special Forces medics to go fight malaria in Chad. You can buy a new cell phone, or if you're sufficiently senior, you could task the National Security Agency with monitoring the cell phone communications of suspected terrorists. You can buy a small chocolate sculpture of a fighter jet. Yes, you actually can. Or you can order a drone strike in Yemen. You name it, the Pentagon supplies it. My friend, retired Lieutenant General Dave Barno, once said to me, I think the US military and the Pentagon has become, it's like Super Walmart, he said. With everything under one roof. And what we've seen in the last two presidential administrations is two successive presidential administrations that have been extremely eager consumers of everything that the Pentagon has to sell. Needless to say, the military's transformation into the world's largest one-stop shopping outfit is not necessarily a cause for celebration. But I think it's both the product and the driver of really seismic changes in how we think about war, with some consequent challenges both to the law, the rule of law, and to the military itself. And in fact, we've become trapped in something of a vicious circle. As the United States faces novel kinds of security threats coming from novel quarters, ranging from threats that come from non-state terror networks that cross borders, to threats that come from cyberspace, to threats that relate to the impact of poverty, repression, genocide, climate change, et cetera. What's happened is that we have gotten into the habit since 9/11 of viewing all of these new kinds of threats through the lens of war and asking the military to take on an ever-expanding range of non-traditional tasks. By viewing more and more threats as war, what we also do is we bring more and more spheres of human activity into the ambit of the law of war, with its much greater tolerance for secrecy, for lethal force, for coercion, and with its reduced protections for human rights. Meanwhile, we ask the military to take on more and more non-traditional tasks. That means you have to find money for it to do that, which means you have to look for savings elsewhere, which means that we end up cutting or freezing the budgets of civilian foreign affairs organizations, State Department, USAID. Budget cuts then cripple those agencies, which means that their capabilities dwindle, which means that we look to the military to pick up the slack even more, and the cycle starts to continue. It's the old adage, if your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If your only functioning government institution is the military, everything starts to look like a war. And if everything looks like a war, then everything looks like a job for the military. And when everything looks like a war, then it looks like war rules. The legal framework for war applies to more and more things. And everything looks like a military mission displaces the civilian institutions and undermines their credibility even while it overloads the military itself. Why does this matter? You all know probably the famous lines from Shakespeare's Henry V. Here's what's at stake when we decide whether to frame something as war or not war. In peace, there's nothing so becomes a man as modest stillness and humility. But when the blast of war blows in our ears, then imitate the action of the tiger. Stiffen the sinews, summon up the blood, disguise fair nature with heart-favored rage, which is a much fancier way than I would ever come up with of saying something that we all know, right? Which is that we expect different things in wartime and from warriors than in peacetime and from people who are not warriors. That we expect in wartime, we expect warriors to act in ways that we would consider immoral and illegal in peacetime. What happens when the boundaries around war begin to blur and when the boundaries around warriors begin to blur is that we lose our ability to decide which actions should be praised and which should be condemned. Throughout human history, human societies have tried to draw sharp lines between war and peace for precisely this reason. You know, until less than a century ago, at least at the formal level, most Western societies insisted that wars should be formally declared, take place on clearly delineated battlefields, be fought by uniformed soldiers who operated within specialized, elaborate, and hierarchical military organizations. In different societies in earlier times, humans have found other ways to mark the boundaries between war and not war, warriors and civilians. I'll give you just a couple of examples. I'm a sort of anthropologist, Monkey, so this for me was the most fun part of researching the book. The Navajo in the American Southwest, literally Navajo warriors would speak a different dialect with different vocabulary when they set out on raids. And then when they came home from raids, the warriors would draw a line in the desert sand. They would turn around, face back their home territory and face away from the enemy territory, step over the line and resume the ordinary language. Among the Makeo in Papua New Guinea, warriors had to wear elaborate masks and elaborate war paint and spend months engaging in various rituals to create war sorcery to enable them to become fearsome warriors who could kill. During that period, they had to abstain both from certain foods and drinks. They also had to abstain from sexual relations during that time period. And when they returned from war, they had to go through a similar period of abstinence, because if they didn't, if they had sexual relations with their spouses before the war sorcery had worn off, if there were any cuts or holes in their bodies, that the idea was that the toxins of war would leach into their bodies, killing them both, that war was conceptualized as literally toxic to ordinary community life and human relationships. And there are lots and lots of other examples. I'm sure you can think of many of them, of rituals that we use to distinguish between war and peace, between warriors and non-warriors. We tend to think that we're different, that these are just things that primitive societies used to do, but of course we do exactly the same thing today. Think of the rituals that relate to basic training for Army or Marine Corps recruits or cadets at our military academies, where their hair is shorn. We strip them of their ordinary clothes and we put them in uniforms with mystical colored ribbons on their chests that can't be decoded except by insiders. They learn a new language. They memorize arcane bits of lore. And indeed, we, much like many of our forebears in other societies, we too name our weapon systems and so on after totem animals and, you know, the predator, the reaper, the hornet. Hoping that we will take on the fearsome characteristics of these beasts when we go to war. And despite the changes, and you know, the function of all these different kinds of rituals is very much the same. The function is to say we want to know the difference between war and not war and warriors and civilians. We need to know the difference. And I'll talk a little bit more about what's at stake in terms of law in a minute. But despite the changes that have been ushered in by 9/11, despite the increasing number of sort of inchoate threats, we still tend to view war as a distinct and separate sphere, something that is totally unrelated to the ordinary world of shopping malls and soccer games and office buildings. And we relegate war to the military, which is a distinct social institution that we simultaneously lionize and ignore. We like to think that war is an easily recognizable exception to the normal state of affairs. And we think of the military as an institution that we can easily, if tautologically, define as the institution that engages in war, whatever that is. Trouble is, in our modern world, the post 9/11 universe, war just isn't a distinct sphere to the extent that it ever was. It clearly isn't anymore. In a world of terror networks that cross borders, of cyber threats, disruptive non-state actors, our traditional categories of war, peace, warrior, civilian don't work very easily anymore. It's gotten harder and harder to figure out how to apply them in a coherent way. And I'll just a few examples. In a war on terrorism or a cyber war, we can't delineate any boundaries in time or in space. It's not clear where the war is. You can't say, aha, the war is in France, but not at Switzerland, it's neutral. You know, you can't say, here is where it is and not here. You can't delineate boundaries in time. Here's where the war began. It's hard to even imagine an ending when you're not dealing with organized state actors or even organized non-state actors. We aren't sure what counts as a weapon anymore. A civilian, hijacked civilian jetliner, a box cutter of the kind you can buy at CVS, a line of malicious computer code. We can't even define the enemy. The United States has been dropping bombs on somebody in Syria for a couple of years now, but I think most Americans, and in my experience, unfortunately also most executive branch officials in the US government, would be hard pressed to articulate who it is that we're fighting against much of the time. And we've also lost any coherent basis for distinguishing between combatants and civilians when we're no longer talking about the uniformed, hierarchically organized military of states or even similarly organized insurgent groups, for instance. We don't know who counts as a warrior and who doesn't. Is a Chinese hacker who is part of hacking into US government computers, is that person a combatant under certain circumstances? What about a financier for Somalia's al-Shabaab? What about a Pakistani teenager who spreads extremist propaganda on Facebook, or a Russian engineer who's paid by ISIS to maintain captured Syrian oil fields? Are they combatants or are they civilians? It's gotten pretty slippery in the context of the ever-metastasizing war on terrorism. And all of this matters, right? And it matters for the very simple reason that we have, when there is a war, the law of war applies, and the law of war gives states and their agents enormous amount of latitude in using lethal force and other forms of coercion. And this is the fancy term lawyers use here is the lex specialis. The law of armed conflict is the lex specialis, means special law. The rest of the law is the lex generalis, the general law. And the lex specialis, the special law, applies in the special circumstance of war. It doesn't apply the rest of the time. But that whole system of saying we have the law of war, it applies in these special circumstances, is obviously premised on the idea that you can tell the difference. That it's easy and straightforward to tell the difference. And we have this elaborate set of rules that only apply during wars. And that's great, and we can tolerate a certain amount of reduced rights protections and greater tolerance for state secrecy, for instance, when our framework is that war is the easily recognizable exception. But obviously, when the boundaries around war get blurry, it gets harder and harder to know when you apply that set of rules and when you don't. In peacetime, obviously, we think that due process is really important. You don't just get to go around and kill somebody. To put it totally bluntly and caricatured a little bit, you know, if I walk outside and I bash the nearest person over the head with my heavy microphone here, you know, we hope that the police come along and arrest me, and I'm charged and I'm tried and I go off to jail for murder or for attempted murder. But if I'm a combatant during wartime and I kill someone who's an enemy combatant, I might even get a medal for it. You know, so the rules are very different. They're profoundly different, the rules, in terms not only of who you can kill, but what circumstances the state can monitor your communications, can detain you, and a whole range of other things, with what degree of due process, what degree of accountability, what degree of secrecy are radically different. Trouble is, if we lose our ability to figure out what counts as a war, you know, if we're not sure anymore when to apply this special set of rules and when that special set of rules don't apply clearly, you know, when we're used to thinking of war as a temporary, an obvious state of exception, and we'll know it when we see it, we'll always know what a war is, you can tell. When we lose that ability to distinguish in a coherent and principled way between what counts as war and what doesn't count as war, we also lose our ability to, we lose any principled basis for making the most important decisions a democracy can make. What matters, if any, should be beyond the scope of judicial review? When can a government have secret laws and engage in secret activities, and when is it not allowed to do that? When can a state monitor the private communications or censor the private communications of citizens? Who can be imprisoned for how long with what degree of due process? And ultimately, who lives and who dies? You know, when and under what circumstances can lethal force be used and against whom? It matters a lot. If we're at war, take an issue like drone strikes that people spend, maybe more controversial than many of the things that I talk about in the book, and probably more publicity. If we're in a war, legally speaking, with Al-Qaeda and its associated forces, and that war extends to wherever the associated forces are, and those associated forces don't have to be wearing a uniform and don't have to be carrying anything that looks like a traditional weapon necessarily, and don't have to be engaged in what traditionally looks like an attack, or maybe thinking of some future something that we construe as an attack, then U.S. drone strikes or other forms of targeted killing are lawful wartime targeting of any enemy combatants, and they're not morally or legally any different than an American soldier on D-Day shooting at a German machine gun nest and killing a German soldier. There's nothing new here if it's a war. If it's not a war, they're just murders. If it's not a war, then the U.S. government is murdering people overseas. So we really want to know the difference, right? We really want to know the difference because we really want to be on one side of that, not on the other side. So a lot is at stake. There are also institutional consequences of this for the military itself. Perhaps of less interest to this audience, but I spend a lot of time talking to military communities, and some of the issues that trouble people in those communities. One of the things that happens when we expand what we label war, you know, when everything looks like a war, then everything looks like a job for the military. And we also lose our ability to make any kind of sound or coherent decision about what tasks should we assign to the military and what tasks should we leave to civilians. So right now we have American military personnel in literally almost every country on Earth, not necessarily in large numbers. In many places the numbers are quite small. But they are not only on almost in almost every country on Earth, but they are undertaking virtually every task on Earth. We have military personnel who launch raids and agricultural reform projects. They plan airstrikes and small business development initiatives. They train parliamentarians and produce TV soap operas. They patrol for pirates. They monitor global email communications. They design programs to prevent human trafficking in the Pacific. And they vaccinate cows. You name it, somebody in the military is doing it. This was actually one of the kind of things that was both slightly terrifying and kind of awe-inspiring when I was at the Pentagon, to realize that pick a topic, pick anything, pick a problem in the world, and someone in that building was working on it, which was kind of amazing, but also kind of alarming, when, depending on your perspective. And I, many years ago, when I was in law school, right around the time that I started doing some consulting work for Gara and Arye, I was also so unsure of what I wanted to do, I interviewed for a job with McKinsey and Company, the management consulting company, and they have this interview process where you're given these elaborate hypotheticals, and you have to come up with, I assume, what the right management consultant kind of thinking is to demonstrate your suitability to be a strategy consultant. And one of the questions that I got was, well, imagine that you run a small mom-and-pop grocery store, and everything is going great, and then one day Walmart announces that they're moving in down the block. You know, what do you do? And I said something like, oh, well, roll over and die, it's all over. And that was apparently was the wrong answer. You know, I was supposed to say something like, you know, oh, I would not go down without a fight. I would find a niche. I would make artisanal Aztec chocolate coffee with soy wood chips from, you know, a collective in Nigeria, and then everybody would come because I would have this special niche that Walmart could not hope to replicate. I would be so interesting and original. And but we all know that, in fact, the odds would be on the wall. The writing's on the wall. The odds would be against me. You know, when Walmart moves down the block, you're in trouble if you're the little mom and pop shop. And like Walmart, today's military can marshal vast resources and exploit economies of scale in a way that the little mom and pop shops cannot hope to replicate. And like Walmart, the tempting one-stop shopping convenience that is offered has had a devastating effect on smaller, more traditional enterprises, which in this case would be enterprises such as the U.S. Department of State, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and so on and so forth. We've seen the State Department, other U.S. civilian foreign policy and foreign assistance agencies shrinking into greater and greater irrelevance when it comes to the foreign affairs of the United States. The Pentagon is not better at promoting agricultural or economic reform than the State Department or USAID is. Most of the time, the Pentagon is somewhat worse at it, not always, since state's record and AID's record's not so great either. But most of the time, however, the military is not as good at it. But unlike USAID and the State Department, what the Pentagon does have at its disposal is millions of employees who are willing to work long hours in horrendous and dangerous conditions, and it's open 24/7. You know, it's fashionable to hate Walmart. I'm sure most of you would not admit to going to Walmart. You know, yuck, we don't go to Walmart. We don't like it because we think the goods it produces are cheap and tacky, and we don't like it because of its sheer vastness and its sort of mindless ubiquity and the sense we all have, I think, of the human pain that's at the heart of the enterprise. And most of the time, we don't want to see Walmart either. We use our zoning laws to exile it and the other big box stores to the commercial hinterlands outside of town, so we don't actually have to look at it. But much as we resent it, many of us would be very hard-pressed to live without it. You know, sooner or later, we all find ourselves going in because it's just so darn convenient. It's cheap. It's got everything. We don't have to go to 18 little places. And as the U.S. military struggles to define its role and mission, it's evoking, I think, some similarly contradictory attitudes from the civilian population. Civilian government officials want a military that costs less but can provide more, a military that will stay deferentially out of strategy discussions but will be eternally available to ride to the rescue, a military that will prosecute our perpetually expanding wars but will not ask us to confront any of the difficult moral or legal questions that are created by the blurring boundaries between war and not war. And we want a military that will solve every global problem, but will be content to stay safely quarantined on isolated bases, separated from the rest of us by barbed wire fences, anachronistic rituals, and often acres of cultural misunderstanding. And indeed, as a footnote, you know, even as the boundaries around war have blurred and as the military's activities have expanded dramatically, the military itself as a human institution has grown, if anything, more and more sharply delineated from the broader society it's charged with protecting, leaving fewer and fewer civilians with the knowledge or the confidence to raise questions about how we define war, how the military operates. It's not actually too late to change any of this. No divine power said, there are these categories called war and not war, and here's what you have to put in them, and there's this category called the military, and only people wearing uniforms can do these tasks, and only people who don't wear uniforms can do these other tasks, and you have to have these rules for war and these rules for peace. You know, that these are categories that are human creations, you know, and I've said earlier, every society has tried to delineate the line between war and peace, but they've done it in different ways with different rules. And some have done it, some have had in-between categories, others have not. So these categories that we have, the content of the law of armed conflict, for instance, the content of our peacetime rules, what goes into them, you know, these are things that we created them, we can change them. They're not any more eternal than the rituals of the Navajo or the rituals of the Old Norse or the Mikeo Indians. Indeed, many of them are of quite recent vintage, that the law of armed conflict essentially stems from the middle of the 19th century, but was particularly codified in the middle of the 20th century. The global institutions that we're used to and much of the content of modern international law is of even more recent vintage, developed in the post-World War II era. So we don't have to accept the a boundaryless world in which wars never end or the military doesn't have any coherent sense of purpose. If we're bothered by the moral and legal ambiguity surrounding, for instance, drone strikes and targeted killing, I've sat in so many rooms filled with lawyers in the last 15 years. This is my fate, right, as a law professor. My fate has been to sit in rooms full of really smart lawyers who argue in circles. And you know, the Human Rights Watch lawyer says, drone strikes are clear human rights violation, and the US government lawyer says, no, clearly they are not. Clearly it is a lawful wartime targeting of enemy combatants, and we kind of keep going in circles because they're just applying different assumptions about what set of rules you're supposed to use. And there's no, the law will not answer those questions. You know, the law, the one thing missing from the law of war is a definition of war. And so there is no possible answer to those questions provided by the legal frameworks themselves. It's a political choice to say, we're going to call this a war, we're going to call this not a war. But we essentially, we have a binary legal framework with radically different rules depending on which category we choose. But we live in a non-binary world. We live in a world in which lots of stuff is in between. You know, lots of stuff doesn't quite look like crime and it doesn't quite look like war. But what we've essentially done is we've put everything in the war box. Lots of different ways to change that, both by changing the categories and by trying to, I think there's sort of an epic failure of imagination collectively in our inability to think beyond these traditional categories to say, hey, wait a minute, we've got some stuff that doesn't look like war, but it doesn't look quite like not war either. But let's think about what we want to accomplish and let's think about what norms and values we want to abide by as we accomplish those goals. It's not easy, but it's not impossible either. If we don't like the simultaneous isolation and Walmartization of the US military, we can change the way we think about recruiting and training and deploying and treating those who serve. We can change the way we define the military's role. We can change the way we treat our civilian foreign policy institutions. And in fact, one of the things that gives me hope in some ways is that one of the audiences that is often most receptive to hearing me talk about these issues has been military audiences, perhaps because very few military leaders want to preside over what they see as the Walmartization of the military. They're very fearful that in the end, the nation's over-reliance on an expanding military that is perpetually trying to keep pace with wars that are infinite will be that the military will risk destroying not only its civilian competition, but ultimately itself, that the military, under constant pressure to be all things to all people, will eventually find itself unable to offer little that is of enduring value to anyway. And if the Walmart metaphor is the right one, the fear is that eventually the military will indeed look like Walmart only the day after the Black Friday sale, stripped bare by a society that is greedy for what it has to offer, but resentful of its dominance at the same time, with nothing left behind but a bunch of demoralized employees and a lot of broken, shoddy merchandise scattered through the aisles. So not an image that anybody particularly likes. I think I'll stop there. There are lots of different directions that I could go in, but this is probably as good a stopping point as any. And I would love to hear your thoughts and your questions and reactions. So thank you very much.
Thank you. There's a microphone up here, and I would like people to come to the microphone. Usually when I've moderated events of this sort, I'm told to say that if anybody asks a question or participates in discussion, they should know that it is being recorded, and this may be used, so be
not by the NSA.
But the NSA may find a way of listening in. And so you have agreed to be recorded in that fashion and to have your words communicated if you participate in the discussion. And if I may, I would like to ask a first question and then invite others to ask questions. Rosa, in a way, I'm still bothered by the question a dozen years ago. That is, are we better off trying to reform or rewrite international humanitarian law to cover some of the ways in which things have developed? Or is it better to leave things be? Because in a way, when you've talked about lex specialis, you've suggested that it provides permission for these activities by the military. But there are also some very significant protections in lex specialis. There are principles that are built into international humanitarian law. There's a principle of humanity. There is a principle of proportionality. There is a principle of distinction. And the concern I have had about modifying or trying to rewrite international humanitarian law is that in the climate that has prevailed since 9/11, are we going to get a revised version of international humanitarian law that is as protective of rights as what we have today? What you said was that the codification took place after World War II, and then further codification took place in 1977, and we got quite good protections into international humanitarian law. I worry as to whether we would get that today.
I think this is the moment where I have to get up and show you that I have a visual aid.
Okay.
My limited ability to draw makes me think I should get my iPad and show it to you. So how many of you are Wittgenstein? So what I'm going to try to show you, if I can pull it up on my iPad, is Wittgenstein's famous duck rabbit. Let's see if I can find the duck rabbit here. This is is a test of OSF's Wi-Fi network, among other things here. Okay, here we go. All right. We recognize this. You've seen this before. And what is it?
Platypus.
Maybe it's pretty. It's a duck. It's a rabbit. So here's how does this relate to anything you ask? Here's the problem. The law of international humanitarian law has got great protections for civilians, for instance, in times of armed conflict. The parties to the conflict are obligated to distinguish between civilians and combatants.
But also protections for the military when they are prisoners.
Absolutely. And these are great if we have any degree of consensus whatsoever on who's a civilian, who is a combatant, who is entitled to the protections of the conventions, and so forth. The trouble is, I think that we've now reached a point where it's almost indeterminate whether to construe a particular individual as being entitled to these protections or not, and indeed whether to construe a particular set of contested activities as a conflict that triggers the applicability of that law or not. So we look at, say, some guy in Yemen who's been targeted by a U.S. drone strike, and human rights groups often look and say, he's a duck, he's a civilian. It's not duck hunting season, you can't do that. The executive branch looks and says, he's not a duck, he's a rabbit. And they're no more likely to reach any conclusion than we are ever to reach a conclusion about whether this little guy is a duck or a rabbit, because the nature of that terminology no longer makes any sense or conforms to any of the original assumptions that used it to create it. And so that's my worry, is that it doesn't matter how good the protections in the law of armed conflict are if you have no basis even for having a conversation. The conversations, and this is very much triggered by having spent so much time in these rooms filled with lawyers, which say, it's a duck, clearly it's a duck, here's why it's a duck. And they're not lying, they're not making it up, they believe it. They've got all sorts of compelling reasons to argue for the duckness, and then the human rights lawyers say, no, clearly you're wrong. I see the exact same thing and I interpret it differently, so a whole different set of rules applies. So the problem becomes, I think, it's a deep problem. It's not a problem of, are the protections in the law of armed conflict insufficient to protect civilians? Well, if we all agree who's a civilian, they're excellent. But if there's no longer even any meaningful basis for having that conversation because we're seeing such radically different things, because the U.S. government is seeing such radically different things than what everyone else, that they're not lying, right? That they're not, it's not bad faith, it's just sort of, it's indeterminate at this point. So to me, that's the deep problem, that when you have a body of rules, it doesn't matter how good they are and how protective they are, if there will always be a reasonable basis for saying, oh yes, but they don't apply.
Look, I'm gonna pursue this. We've always had these arguments. I can remember in the war in El Salvador, and one of the things that was going on then is that the Salvadoran Air Force, which was wholly a creature of the United States, was attacking civilians in the countryside. They were called Masas. They were the people who supported the guerrillas in that territory. That is, they grew the crops which the guerrillas relied upon to feed themselves. And so the Salvadoran military was attacking these civilians and claiming that they were legitimate targets of attack because they were growing these crops. But we had a basis for arguing in international humanitarian law, and we made the argument and eventually prevailed. in that argument. And international humanitarian law does have significant protections in it. It's always possible for people to distort anything that is written into law. But you need a basis for making the argument. And I worry that if we start making revisions in, again, this post 9/11 era, that we're going to end up worse rather than better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think that's a totally misplaced concern, but I do think something has changed, right? I mean, always the law of international humanitarian law was always imposing on reality a tidier framework than in fact existed. And on the margins, there have always been cases that were difficult to categorize, you know, partisans and guerrillas. Also, there's always been bad faith. You know, there, of course, have always been actors who are willing to say, oh, that's not a civilian, when, you know, most objective observers would say, yes, that was a civilian. Of course that's a civilian. I think what has happened recently is a little bit different, though. You know, I don't think it's as simple as the occasional hard-to-categorize case or simple bad faith on the part of the U.S. government, for instance, in saying, oh, all those drone strike targets, they're, you know, clearly they're combatants, when clearly they're not. You know, I think it's a deeper problem that does have to do with the changing nature of conflict, which increasingly involves non-state actors and non-traditional kinds of threats that do just... So we're no longer seeing challenges to the framework on the margins and coming from actors who are not acting in good faith, but instead we're seeing more and more challenges that are kind of central to the categories themselves and really undercut the whole system. That's separate from saying, I mean, I think your concern might still stand regardless, because you could say, hey, look, this is a variant of Donald Rumsfeld. You know, you don't go to war with the army. You go to war with the army you have, not the army you wish you had. That you go to war with the law you have, not the law that you might wish you had. And that, in fact, this is the law that we have. And if you start that you're more likely to succeed in protecting rights by insisting that it's crystal clear and erring on the side of including more people in the categories that get protection than you are by saying, hey, these categories are really hard to apply. Maybe we need something different.
Yeah, and I would say that with respect to the drone strikes, the argument has continued, but I would say over time, the drone strikes seem to have been more narrowly focused than they were at the beginning. In the early days, for example, drone strikes would target the home of the person who mm-hmm. was the target. But that home was likely to house three generations. There'd be a dozen members of the family in the home who were not themselves combatants. And then, you know, eventually they shifted to targeting these people as they got into vehicles. Because at the moment that they were getting into vehicles, they were not likely to be accompanied by their children. They were likely to be accompanied by other militants. And a variety of changes were made, which seemed to diminish the problems. And I think that took place because of the arguments mm-hmm. About the abuses which were related to those drone strikes. So I don't want to lose the capacity to make yeah. those arguments.
I don't share your feeling that things have gotten better. I think those of us in the human rights community have spent 15 years trying to use the law that we have, and we have failed. And what we have instead created, or we've witnessed the creation of a system in which no one is challenging fundamentally the fundamental point that the U.S. government is making, because it's sort of unchallengeable given the existing frameworks, which is that the law of conflict is the right framework for applying in these settings. Once you concede that, you've already lost much of the battle that I think you care about. And I think that what troubles me much, much more, you know, I say this with an enormous amount of respect for the people who are making these decisions, who I think are acting in good, certainly in this administration, are acting in good faith, are trying really, really hard not to kill anybody who they think doesn't count as a combatant, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, we have ended up legitimizing a secret war which has killed thousands of people that is almost entirely formally unacknowledged and developed a theory about sovereignty that is really, really destabilizing internationally, setting precedents that are quite horrifying internationally when others turn around and use them, because we have created a situation, to put it very bluntly, where we are essentially saying, because we are applying the law of war framework, we're essentially saying, hey, we, the United States, decide when the law of war applies and when it doesn't. And when we decide that it applies in a given situation, then we get to kill anybody, anywhere in the world, based on reasons that we don't have to disclose to anybody because they're secret. And in wartime, you don't have to have a court signing off on who you kill and so on.
I'm not disagreeing with any of that. I'm saying that...
this doesn't seem like a success to me.
It isn't a success, but there have been certain modifications which come about on the basis of the law of war as it exists. Mm-hmm. And I worry that, if anything, it would be worse if we start a process mm-hmm. of revising the international law of armed conflict.
I don't know that you necessarily have to revise it. I think I come at it from a slightly different perspective, which is that as long as you're still sort of fighting on the terrain of the law of war, you can make these very tiny marginal differences. It seems to me that the more important thing for all of us to be saying is, you know what, U.S. government, you're right. If the law of war applies, then you get to do all these things. But we don't want to live in a world where the government does all these things. We don't want to live in a world where other states do all these things. So let's think about whether there is a different set of rules that should apply, a different set of rules that we have to create that says, you know, the end of the story should not be, aha, it's an armed conflict, therefore, as long as we're careful not to kill the little children, everything else is, anything goes, you know, that we want to live in a world in which we say, hey, wait a second, when one state can kill around the world without disclosing even that it is killing, that's a problem. Let's come up with some set of rules for saying, let's place some limits on that, or let's impose some transparency requirements, or let's create some checks and balances. So I don't think you can get at that from within the framework of international humanitarian law.
I don't want to monopolize the discussion, so let me invite others to come up and ask questions.
I don't want to muddy this, but ask for opinion on two different things that we had a problem literally from the get-go. The Continental Army, created before the Declaration of Independence, along with the Military Academy, which was our first school of engineering, and the Corps of Engineers that went with that, which was intended to do civilian works for most of its existence, were there before the Declaration of Independence. And in fact, we occupied territory before in hopes that they would join us, Montreal, Quebec. So we were pushing the boundaries from the get-go. The Department of Defense has actually been a leader, never asked for its opinion on environmental things. They've long signaled their concern of the impact of climate change on causing vast amounts of refugees, the water shortages, and the like. But on another level, of one of the factors that's causing it, the use of fossil fuels, the Southwestern Division of the Corps of Engineers said, no fracking, in fact, no other kinds of drilling near any vulnerable facilities like dams and reservoirs and bridges and tunnels. No one is paying attention. And yet we have people in the civilian realm asking to or engaging in militarizing things, as we have the terrible situation in all the police forces, the preceding mayor of this city referring to NYPD as his army. So where do we do that if we have this, we started in an innocent basis of expecting it to both be there standing on the side, you know, when we need it to do it, that it has this level of expertise, and then we, as you say, want to imply a war on everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot in there, so I don't think I'm going to be able to touch on all the issues that you raise, but I do think, you know, so if you're a glass half empty person, you look around and you go, oh goodness, we've seen the militarization of U.S. foreign policy and the militarization of all these things, and that's bad. If you're a glass half full person, maybe you say, oh, you know, we're seeing the civilianization of the military, which is an institution which has enormous potential to do all kinds of good things, and so that's okay. And you know, here's a story that was, I'll radically oversimplify it. Former colleague of mine who was serving in Afghanistan as a senior army officer in about 2006-2007, you know, the army looks around, they say, oh gosh, you know, it doesn't matter how many military victories we have over the Taliban, Afghanistan will never be stable unless the agricultural economy is diversified, is not so dependent on opium poppies. And so basically, they call up the Department of Agriculture in Washington and say, hi, Department of Agriculture, could you please send some agricultural experts over here to Afghanistan to work with Afghans, you know, help them figure out what to do about their agricultural economy. And of course, the Department of Agriculture says, you know, well, no, first of all, there are only two of us, and second of all, we're really busy, and third, we don't want to go to Afghanistan. And so the Army does what the Army does, which is it kind of says, well, we must get agriculture people here. And they look around, they say, hey, we've got all these farmers in the National Guard and the Reserve. Let's get the farmers here. And 6 months later, you've got a battalion, basically, of American farmers in Afghanistan. Does this mean that they're going to be any good at all at focusing on Afghans? You know, no, of course not. Many of them are thinking to themselves, gee whiz, you know, I have a garden. I don't know anything about Afghanistan. It doesn't mean I know anything about this. But the kind of amazing thing about it, right, is that this is the only institution that this country has that is capable of marshaling that much human talent and energy, you know, that the military can get more people and more stuff to more places faster than anything else we have. And that is a resource to the United States and to the world, and we certainly see it in humanitarian crises, can get more stuff faster. And so I do think it is worth thinking. I think that our, you know, our assumption, and I think it's an assumption that is widely shared both in this country on the left, but also in the military itself. Our immediate assumption is, aha, we need to get the military out of the business of doing all this stuff. But I think we should probably ask ourselves, you know, should we instead be saying, hey, we have this incredible tool. Let's think about how we adapt it and use it to achieve our national goals, which should be a lot broader than just killing people here and there, and which are a lot broader than killing people in there and there. And is it possible to do that? And that's a whole different set of questions that I think we don't think about very much because we're so habituated to thinking, oh no, that's not the military, it goes over here, the civilians do this, we need to keep them apart.
Michael? Come to the mic.
Something, I so appreciate your perspective because, unlike most of us, you've been inside, and so you can come out and tell us, like, you know, what it's like there. And you have all this respect for what people are doing, but there's an elusiveness in your presentation that I sort of want to press you because there's an implicit critique of the situation in your talk, mm-hmm. that we're assigning way too much to the military. You yourself said these people don't know how to do agriculture in Afghanistan. I read the reports in Afghanistan. I mean, the press coverage is all about the military. There's never an Afghani, like, interviewed. So we have no idea what's going on. I mean, where ultimately do you come down on the fact that the military has come to occupy this role? Don't we need to imagine... it was interesting in your exchange with Arya, you came out much more strongly about the inadequacy of our current structure. But do you ultimately imagine a much different type of structure?
Yes, I do. And in fact, I don't mean to be at all elusive. I not only am I exhausted by sitting around in rooms full of lawyers going around in circles, but I am also very exhausted of sitting around in rooms full of earnest people in Washington having the following conversation where people go, oh goodness, it's so sad that so many resources and authorities have flowed to the military and away from the civilian agencies, and we need to fix that. We need to rebalance. We need to move resources authorities back to the civilian sector. And everybody sits around and nods. And I get tired of that conversation because it's been going on for two decades. And I've started to say to people, do you think there is any chance whatsoever in our political lifetimes that that will happen, that Congress, everybody in Congress wakes up one morning and says, oh my goodness, we've put too much money on the defense side. We really need to really radically rebuild. No, there is no, and everybody says, no, there is zero chance that that will happen. And it seems to me that if there is in fact zero chance that that will happen, zero, which I think there is, that at some point you have to start saying, instead of sitting around wringing our hands and saying, too bad the military is doing all this stuff, and too bad they do it so badly, you know, if only we could just fix that, that we have to say that won't be fixed by moving things back to the good old days, you know, when the civilians did all that stuff and put the military back in its box where it only fights wars. It's time to start saying, if the military is doing this stuff now and is likely to continue to be asked to do it and told to do it for the foreseeable future, let's figure out what we need to do to make the military do it more effectively, more transparently, and more accountably. And that's a very different project than sort of sitting around saying, oh, gee, the military shouldn't do this stuff. So okay. Does that come down on?
Before Occupy Wall Street and then Bernie Sanders, everybody said you can't do anything about the economy, the inequality, and so things change very radically. And I just don't think we should accept the idea that what is has to be.
I agree we don't have to accept that what is has to be, but I also, you know, and there are certainly areas in the book where I argue for some fairly utopian changes, particularly to international institutions. But this is one where I also think that I think we get so fixated on artificial categories that were created for convenience. You know, the categories of war, peace, military, civilian, were created to help us achieve certain normative goals. There's nothing sacred about them, absolutely nothing from my perspective. So I don't find it that, to me, this is not so much a question of wouldn't it clearly be better if something else? To me, this is a failure of imagination. This is just, you know, I don't care. I really don't care what label we attach to the institution that does things that we think ought to happen. I would just like someone to do it and to do it well and to do it in a way that is consistent with the values that I care about that have to do with human rights, that have to do with democratic accountability, et cetera. So for me, this isn't one where it's wouldn't it be better to go back? I don't think it would be better to go back. I don't think you can go back. I think that the various genies that got out of their boxes in the last few decades are not going away, that we're going to continue to inhabit a world in which attempting to apply the old categories will be close to impossible, and that I would rather see us reimagine the military and reimagine the laws and institutions in that space that doesn't quite fit into the old war box or the old peace box, then try to go back. And so that's not so much premised on a pessimism about the possibilities of political change as it is in part also premised on a conviction that we are clinging to categories that we should just stop clinging to because they don't matter and they're not doing what we want them to do.
We now see various hands. In order, I saw the gentleman over here, the gentleman in the back, then Marine, and then the woman in front.
Thank you for introducing the subject so well, but I would like to reverse it and say that the writing of law will never end, will always be employed. The agreement about the wordings will also never end. There is one thing that will make a difference, And that is a well-modulated form of witnessing, of being able to record what actually happened. We see this in the way in which we got used to the police forces in various cities recording practically everything that was always accused, the Black Lives Matter and so forth. There are people there. I'm an economist, not a lawyer, and looked at what happened in Kosovo. In Kosovo, the United States said there is a tremendous argument between all of the little nations of what used to be the Balkans, and that the US Air Force is now going to bomb the bridges across the main rivers outside Belgrade. At which point, the citizens of Belgrade lined up on the bridges and said, "You will never bomb these bridges so long as we're standing there." Witness has come on so many civil rights issues, where there are wars, as on the enormous frontiers between the Arab and Israel countries, and what has to be done. That witness is much more powerful than the ability to write laws, so much so that for many years the United States refused to be a party to the International Court of Justice on the criminal level, because it would be too tempting for any country in the world to say that the Pentagon was at stake. They were using bombs, they were using terrible firepower. To which the answer was, yes, the more evidence we get on the ground, the more that we can film what's happening, it is the perpetrators who are going to be in a very tough position. And they're simply going to have to either get be a lot more clever in how they are going to go for civil wars and whatever else, or do it in the dark. But what really matters is that we will no longer be party to it. And that so long as there is the evidence on record, there is always a threat that the people who are committing the crimes will be in a bad position. One example.
I want to get to other people as well, so perhaps we can make the example very brief or skip the example.
Yes.
I think your point about witnessing is a really important one, and I say this against interest, since I'm a law professor and my bread and butter involves trying to encourage people to think about the law, but I think that in many ways the lawyers have dominated this set of conversations about post 9/11 conflicts in ways that have been really detrimental, because I do think that, and this is part of the frustration of we go around in circles because we're debating legal categories, and at the end of the day, fundamentally there is a great deal of human misery and human suffering and tragedy that is arising from decisions that lawyers can easily justify. And I think if we keep our focus on that, if we keep our focus squarely on that, that helps us move in the direction of no longer arguing about what label to apply and then thinking to ourselves, oh good, you know, it's legal because look, the law of armed conflict applies or whatever, and therefore I can sleep well at night, and draws our attention right back to saying, that's really not the most interesting or useful or morally relevant way to think about this. If something is happening that is appalling to us on a human level, then let's start thinking about creating new rules and institutions to change it rather than getting so wound up in the old ones.
Okay, all the way in back.
I'm just going to shout out a quick question and then come up.
It's for the vast viewing audience not currently in this room, and your words will be lost to posterity if you don't come up to the microphone.
My quick question is, what happens, do you think, when the Chinese send a drone to assassinate a
a Tibetan nationalist, or the Iranians do the same somewhere, or Erdogan and the Turks assassinate a Kurdish, assassinate is probably the wrong way, they will say it's the law of war, this is a proximate threat. What does the United States do? What is the argument?
We are screwed. because we say, don't do that, you shouldn't kill that nice dissident. And they say, oh no, that was not a nice dissident, that was a combatant in an armed conflict against us. And we say, no, it wasn't, we think that was a dissident. And they say, oh, but we have evidence. And we say, well, let's see it. And they say, well, no, unfortunately, we can't share it with you for national security reasons. We know you'll understand. And we kind of go, oh.
And how many years are we from now?
Oh, it's happening.
With drones, and drones
are irrelevant, right? Drones are just another way to drop stuff that kills people from the sky. And from a moral perspective, you know, whether it could be the poisoned umbrella, you know, or the radioactive sushi.
Yeah, I'm just from the drone.
Yeah, no, we're there.
Okay, Maureen?
Many thanks, Rosa, for the talk. Much appreciated. I'm not talking from a lawyer's perspective, but from a humanitarian practitioner perspective. Mm-hmm. And some of the consequences of what you're describing in terms of the blurring of the lines between civilians and combatants, mm-hmm. and how that's defined and by whom, as well as the question of a proportionality and distinction, mm-hmm. is creating for those that are providing medical services at the front line of conflict a major issue.
Yeah.
And we were very comfortable with the boxes, because the boxes helped us have a basis upon which we could explain our presence and negotiate our presence. And now we're finding ourselves in the situations where the carpet is just being pulled from under our feet. Now, those protections were never perfect. We know that.
Right.
But at least they offer the framework that we feel we no longer even know whether it's applicable and we can claim it or not. And it's pushing some people from the ICRCs to the MSF of this world, you know, to say that maybe what we're witnessing today is also gonna, in a way, you know, generate the end of the possibility of Dunantist humanitarian action,
right.
which is premised on the idea that you can provide impartial care in conflicts on the basis of needs only. And I wonder if you could, you know, share some thoughts about that. I did read the book. I didn't, you know, find that line of reasoning, but I wonder if you could share some thoughts.
Yeah, it's a really hard issue, and the whole issue is sort of shrinking humanitarian space, and is there any possibility of kind of reclaiming that? And I'm very pessimistic about that. I think that both the U.S.'s actions and developments in other parties, obviously, have challenged that, and it may be impossible to return to that in any, you know, reasonable time frame that we would like. I don't have any answer whatsoever except that I recognize and share that worry. I do think that going back in some ways to the question, the challenge that Arye posed to me, one of the things that I find most chilling, and the U.S., I don't, only somebody who's sort of deeply in the weeds probably actually read this memo, but there was a 2011 Justice Department memo on it was leaked on the legal theory behind the targeting of Anwar al-Awlaki, U.S. citizen, who was killed by a U.S. drone strike in 2011. And one of the things that I found most shocking and distressing about the legal analysis in that memo had to do with proportionality and necessity. Forgive me, those of you who are not particularly interested in the legal piece of this, but the argument, the standard argument for the use of force in the law of armed conflict framework, but in the sort of use ad bellum framework, is that you don't use force unless there's a threat that is imminent, and that then the use of force is to be proportionate to the threat itself. And the memo that the Justice Department authored made the argument that the nature of terrorist plots is such that all terrorists are at all times seeking to find ways to harm the United States, and that therefore by definition, but that we can't know what those plots are, because that's also the way terrorists work. They, you know, they're secretive. We don't see an army massed on the border. So we cannot know. The nature of the threat that they posed is unknowable. The timing is unknowable. The scale is unknowable. And thus we need to regard the threat as always imminent, which entitles us then to target Alaqui when he's sitting in a cafe or he's driving here or there. So, you know, we don't have to wait for him to pick up a gun and point it at somebody or some similar thing. But the trouble with that, in addition to sort of eliminating any meaning to the whole concept of imminence, is if by definition we cannot know the magnitude or nature of the threat, it becomes impossible to conduct any kind of proportionality analysis that any level of force is proportionate to, because we have no idea what the, you know, it could be he's going to kill one person, it could be he's a nuclear bomb, we don't know. So it renders the traditional analysis impossible to undertake by definition. And don't get me started, because I'll go on and on and on about this, but you know, and added to that, the fact that we only know about this particular bit of Orwellian legal analysis because of a leaked memo, you know, I think for me, one of the most chilling and shocking things as an American citizen about what has happened in the last 15 years is that huge swathes of U.S. foreign policy and law have disappeared into the covert world. And I just find that morally shocking, because among other things, it makes witnessing hard, if nothing else.
Okay. Yes.
I personally do not see any end to the existence of non-state actors. Their names might change, but they will continue. It's going to be the conflicts of the 21st century. Now, the militarization of civilian functions, like in terms of development, that actually, in carrying on from the previous question, is actually endangering the actual civilian groups, the international NGOs, that are trying to continue carrying out these functions and are more effective than the military, because they are actual specialists. Where the, what you described, what the military is sending in, quote, farmers who, you know nothing about Afghan agriculture. And they're not going to really do anything about the opium, you know. So, you know, what you're doing is people who could change are going to be targets from the non-state actors.
Yeah. So I got myself in some hot water a few years ago, because I wrote a kind of a tongue-in-cheek column suggesting that the U.S. military, if the U.S. military was going to continue to do all these things, you know, micro-enterprise programs for Afghan women or whatever, that the military should stop recruiting in high school boys and start recruiting at the American Association of Retired People conference instead. And everybody sort of said, that's ridiculous. The United States still recruits primarily young males between 18 and 22 or 23, which makes perfect sense if your conception of a military task is that you need a lot of guys who can march carrying heavy loads, getting into firefights, and you need physical stamina and you need physical endurance. On the other hand, if you think that much of the time, for most people, most of the time you want them to be doing agricultural reform or micro-enterprise or whatever it may be, it's not obvious that you want to recruit high school boys for those tasks, right? That there are people who know something about this, and it doesn't tend to be 18-year-old boys or even 28-year-old captains. So I do think, you know, there are, we would, if we in fact were to decide that the only way to improve the current situation, we can't, there's no other actor who's able to just assume the same scale of activities, but we wanted the military to not be bad at it, that would have pretty radical implications for how we recruit, how we train, et cetera, in the military. That's not your point, I realize, but it's not inevitable that the military is bad at this. And that's a different issue. I don't know whether to some extent you're also raising the issue that Maureen raises about humanitarian space and what happens when the person... Yeah, yeah. And as I said earlier, I don't have an answer to that, except that I think that it's gone. The humanitarian space is gone. It's gone. It's partly the United States' fault. It's partly not. But either way, it's gone. And we can't wish it back. You know, I and this makes me feel very sad. But I don't think that if the U.S. military tomorrow stopped doing every single thing it does that isn't, strictly speaking, sort of a good old-fashioned Clausewitzian military activity, I don't think that suddenly, magically, non-state actors would stop targeting humanitarian workers. I don't think that for a minute, unfortunately.
One last question. Go ahead. Yes.
I'm so sorry I lost the first half of your lecture. But being from Middle East, I would be the last person on earth to defend American military. But these poor guys, since 9/11, they're just the most ignorant people on earth. They had never had these traditional enemies that they always had throughout the history of the United States. You're talking about dealing with ISIS, kids who are suicide bombers. They have no, you know, the war that started with our lovely President Bush had no idea what Sunni and the Shia were. They don't know. Then we have a presidential candidate, aside from Hillary Clinton, who doesn't know what Aleppo is. I mean, you have a bunch of ignorance running the military. What do you expect from them? What do you truly expect from them?
That problem cuts across all sectors of American society, unfortunately. Yeah, I don't know if that problem is restricted to the U.S. military, as opposed to, as you say, we have presidential candidates who couldn't find.
They
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That problem is beyond the scope of the book.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I again recommend the book, so if you want to purchase it, there are copies available.
The answers
outside
to all your questions are actually contained in the book, but you have to buy it, and copies for your relatives and stuff like that.
Rosa, thank you very much.
Thank you, Aryeh.